You're fine, Alec.
Thank you.
Just remember my mantra, which is the subtagline of this podcast, God damn it, Cassidy.
God damn it, Cassidy.
Doesn't it have a nice ring to it?
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is Keith Foster, my co-host from San Diego, California.
Okay, I'm going to do something. I always start the podcast off like super, like...
Manic?
No. I just with more energy. And by the end of the episode, it tapers off. So I'm going to try to keep my energy up. With me is Cassidy Robinson, the host of this show from Los Angeles, California. I have noticed, though, that I'm saying a lot more. So I'm going to try to tone that down.
All right. We appreciate it. And with us is a friend of the podcast and I guess reoccurring guest now, Alec Ingerson from Northern Hollywood.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah, I guess the second time is the charm.
Mm-hmm.
So not, I'm like a...
Not quite Five Timers Club yet, but you're on your way.
I'm okay. Making moves.
I have a question. Sure. What's the difference between Los Angeles and North Hollywood, you fucking snobs?
Literally nothing. I would have been perfectly fine being told I'm from Los Angeles.
I mean, technically, you are from Los Angeles, but you're on the other side of the hill.
Yeah, it's true. I'm in the valley, and if you live not in the valley, you're like, oh, fuck the valley. Everyone hates the valley. Can I curse on this podcast?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, you can say whatever you fucking want.
It would have been a big handicap.
I'm not from California originally, like most people in California, so I actually don't mind the valley. I actually kind of like it. I think it's homey and like suburban and nice. And I know that that's like uncool. You're supposed to like the places that like were dangerous 5 years ago and are now gentrified. But I like the valley. I like Orange County. I like being able to find like a plethora of like modern strip mall restaurants easily.
Where does the valley start?
Ventura, basically.
I don't know what you guys.
But if it makes you feel any better, Cassidy, the area in the valley I live has been gentrified over the last 5 years. I've literally watched it occur and take partial blame for it.
That's what I'm hoping happens to my neighborhood.
It is a double-edged sword, man. I'm gonna have to move soon.
We own, so we're good.
Oh, well,
maybe.
I am just watching white people with dogs walk through my neighborhood and plant Starbuckses. It's been a trip.
With their dogs as co-owners of the franchises. Yeah. That's the new thing.
That's why dogachinos or whatever are now a thing. Fucking dogs are top owners of Starbucks.
A pup cup?
Pup cup. Is that what it's called? That's adorable.
If it's not, and Keith just invented it, we have now started a new business, NTM.
Yeah, pup cups.
Today we're going to be talking about Spike Lee's Black Klansman, and at the end of the program, me and Alec will review another Spike Lee film from 2006, Inside Man, which was on Netflix. We got a few things to do before that point, and since you're the guest, Alec, I'm going to let you be our first entry into the Consume Obey of the Week. What have you been consuming? What have you been watching, listening to, reading? What are you obsessed with?
Right now I'm pretty obsessed with an author named Jason Reynolds, actually. I've read about 5 of his books in the last month and a half.
Wow.
Now, partially that's because of work, but it's also because I find him unbelievably fascinating. He is from New York. He grew up in a rougher part of town. He's a black author. He had not read a book until he turned 17. He talked about how it just felt uncool in his neighborhood, how no one read books because you didn't want to be that dude on the book that people are pointing at 11 goes, ah, I mean, dude on the train, rather, people are pointing at 11 go, ah, he's reading a book. So he didn't read until he was 17. But then when he found the joy of reading, he fell for it pretty hard, but he started to feel like books weren't made for people like him. You know, brown kids did not get the light in books the way he wanted, so he just exclusively started writing books for people like himself. And he wrote, I'm gonna fuck this up, but I think he wrote 8 books in like 4 years.
Wow.
And they're young adult, you know, they're easy reads. But I have gotten through them wicked quick. Shout out to his track series, which I think is genius. He has a great Miles Morales novelization that I'm almost done with.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's really, really dope. And he also has a book called When I Was the Greatest that is the first book of his I read and what kind of launched a lot of this obsession. He's growing. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Is he, you mentioned Miles Morales and like the Spider-Man thing. Has he written for Marvel, like in comics?
To my knowledge, he has not written any comics. He's written just books and a collection of poems. But he did just the novelization version of a Miles Morales story. No actual pictures.
Okay, cool. Okay, Keith, what have you been consuming? What have you been reading, watching? What are you obsessed with?
I gotta limit this down to one thing. So I told you a little bit ago that I was playing Zelda Breath of the Wild on Nintendo Switch, right? Mm-hmm. So I was playing that game, and it's fine. Like, it's a good game. But really, it just made me want to reinvest in Witcher 3, which I never beat many, many years ago. And so there's a lot of content left to do, plus some downloadable content. So I recently got way back into Witcher 3, the video game. And
is this Zelda related, or is it just a whole different thing?
Oh, yeah, I guess I forgot to connect the two.
Yeah, I know nothing about video games.
I was playing Zelda Breath of the Wild, and I just couldn't help but feel disappointed by it. Every time I played it, I was like, I just want to be playing Witcher again. Mm-hmm. So that's what made me go back to it, because the gameplay is similar enough that it just reminded me of all the good things about Witcher, but just also made me like see all the stuff that Zelda was missing in comparison to Witcher. Does that make sense?
Sure,
yeah, totally.
Okay, so I went back and started replaying that, and then I decided, since I'm playing the game, I want to get more into this world, and I've been listening to the audiobooks by I'm not going to be able to pronounce his name. He's a Polish writer, Andrzej Sapkowski?
Sounds Polish.
You should have committed. I would have believed you either way.
And Andrzej Sapkowski. So the Witcher series was based on these books. And then I think he wrote one more book since the games came out. I don't know. But it was like this fantasy series about this Witcher, this guy who hunts monsters. This game company took this very obscure fantasy series and was like, this would make a fucking cool RPG. And so they took this weird Polish fantasy books and made a game out of it. And it's super awesome game. And the books are a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've never heard of any of that, but I'll take your word for it.
I've been meaning to get into The Witcher. I'm a big like Skyrim and Elder Scrolls kind of fella. And I'm told that it would give me my fix between scroll games.
It will make you... Okay, I love Elder Scrolls. I devoted probably a good fourth of my life to Skyrim.
Oh, yeah.
I think Witcher as a video gaming experience is better.
Interesting.
It's open world, very similar to Skyrim, but I think the combat mechanics are a lot more smooth, and just narratively... The story is a lot more compelling because you're playing this established, you know, well-written character with a very well-established world around him. Whereas Skyrim, you're making your own character up. So narratively, I don't think it's as strong.
Mine's a little kind of like weird because it's not like one thing, and it's not even necessarily like media that I've already consumed, but I've had the best thrifting weekend of my adult life.
Okay.
I went to my bank, as I always do on Friday in Santa Monica, to drop off my check and, divide things evenly. And across from my bank, there's a really small Goodwill that I always pop in just to see if there's anything I might be interested in. Because it's Santa Monica, so rich people give away their stuff, and it's a little bit nicer than the other Goodwills. And there wasn't a whole lot of anything, except for when I was looking in their DVDs, which is usually a crapshoot. They had seasons 2 through 5 of The Wire for like $2 each.
Wow. Nice. That's a good find.
Yeah, I bought the fuck out of that, but then I didn't have season 1. So I went on kind of like a Goodwill marathon for that rest of that afternoon, hoping that I would run into season 1, which of course I didn't.
No, that's insane. Why would you assume that?
Why would you even tell us the story?
Clearly, if someone had season 1, they would have dropped it off at the same Goodwill.
You don't think they would have just left it somewhere else as a fuck you? Please find a bunch of... Were there clues? Did you find clues anywhere?
It's like a Goodwill scavenger hunt.
That's what I'm proposing. From now on, if you're going to get rid of multiple... like seasons of things or like multiple components of things, multiple volumes, whatever, make it a fucking quest.
Oh, and they put little like post-it notes in the insides of each DVDs with like, riddles to tell you which other store to go to.
Invisible ink, you have to put lime juice on it.
Well, it wasn't quite that exciting, except for, so I went to a couple Goodwills and I was already on that side of town, so I decided to pop into this record store that I go to down over on Santa Monica Boulevard called the Record Surplus. And they have like one of the better like DVD sections in town for used stuff. And while I was there, I did not find The Wire season 1, but I did find the Star Wars box set Laserdisc from 1993.
Wow.
That has like, it has the first 3 Star Wars films, obviously, the only ones that there were at the time. It comes with a big like coffee table book full of all these like interviews, like 2 different forewords, 1 from Spielberg, 1 from Coppola. Really great kind of like film resource. And then it comes with like a little guide for what's on each side of the Laserdisc. Really good condition. I mean, like in this beautiful like briefcase looking box that everything goes in. Everything's in multiple sleeves. I took pictures. Put it on my DVD collecting subreddit, and I thought that was amazing, which it is. But when I came home,
have a question.
Sure.
So you found this on Laserdisc. I mean, it sounds like an amazing collection, right?
And I should say this isn't. I mean, it's rare that you see it in the wild. But yes, obviously you can go to eBay and find it or whatever.
Sure. I mean, you can say that.
I found it for like $45, which is a little more rare, and to find in such good condition.
Do you have a Laserdisc player?
Not really, no.
Fucking piece of shit. Set follow-up question.
Sure.
Are you going to get a Laserdisc player?
Probably now, yes.
Just to watch this?
Well, to see the exclusive special features to it, yeah, and to see how it plays, and that's going to open up a new chapter of like collecting dead media.
Okay.
I actually do own a Laserdisc. I own a Georges Méliès collection.
Well, there you go.
I don't even know fuck that means.
Oh, he's the father of modern cinema, man.
Yeah, he did the Trip to the Moon, the one that the Smashing Pumpkins riff on for Tonight.
There's something you have to understand. So Cassidy is a film critic. He went to school for it and everything. I'm just a comedian who likes movies.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's our dynamic.
Yeah.
Okay, but the story's not done, because I came home and I saw on my Facebook app that Amoeba Records was going to be doing a sidewalk sale on Saturday. Ooh. So I decided, if I don't find it there for cheap, or if I don't find it in the sidewalk sale, I'm sure they're going to have season 1 of The Wire. I can finish this up. So I went there, And they did have it for like $10, a little bit more than I paid for at the Goodwill, but still, now it's complete. And even more importantly, I found one of the white whales I've been hunting almost my entire adult life. And that is the DVD collection of the Judd Apatow series Undeclared, which is I haven't seen in a store since like 2005. And I check every time, and every time I'm like, fuck you, Ugly Betty, I'm looking for Undeclared.
You know, the DVD shop right near my apartment, you know, that one on the corner of Lancashire and Violent, I just told everyone who listens to your podcast where I live. Scary. I'm going to get murdered. Anyway, they're going out of business, and...
Oh, I did know that. I think I saw... And they're everything's like half off or something.
Oh, it's... Right? I've been just throwing paychecks away.
Hey, Angelinos, you guys just lost our 4 non-California-based listeners.
Damn. I'm just going to hop on the 405 and cry about it.
So, yeah, that was my big weekend. It was I spent more in gas trying to find season one of The Wire than I probably did on the other cool things that I ended up finding instead. Now we're going to get into our listener survey, which I posted up, I think, around Wednesday or so. There's this whole thing going on. I was explaining to you guys on film Twitter. I think this started by Leonard Maltin's daughter, Jessie Maltin, for her followers to post the first four films that they were obsessed with in like picture format. We don't have to go as far into it as that, but I did post the question to our listeners of what were the first movies they remember being obsessed with as you know, as a kid or adult or whatever. And I'll go through these and we can react, and then we'll give ours at the end. But John Morello says Jaws. We had a swimming pool with lights. When I was a kid, my dad would put the red tinted light covers on to make the pool look blood red. I never went past the shallow end of the pool for a long time.
Oh, that's freaking amazing. Shout out, great parents.
Yeah. When I was a kid, actually, I had a similar thing. Because I saw Jaws when I was pretty young. And then, if I was in a pool that had, lines for swim lanes, that would kind of look like really elongated, uppercase I's, right? So they have like a little crossbar on the front and bottom. And as a kid, like if I had goggles or like just looking at them through the water, it with my imagination, they would become hammerhead sharks and it would really freak me out.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, everybody went through the scared of water Jaws phase, I think, or at least people of a certain age.
Yeah.
I was afraid of waterbeds.
But that shouldn't that be more like Nightmare on Elm Street thing?
Well, I hadn't seen it yet, but I did know that water and sharks go together. My cousin Graham, who answered a very similar question the last time we did this, uses a very similar answer, Last of the Mohicans. He's just all about that Last of the Mohicans lifestyle.
I guess so.
I'm so confused by that. What? Why? What about that movie?
I don't know. Just the last question we asked was, what movie have you bought in the most formats? And that was his answer for that. So I guess it makes sense that, you know, if he was obsessed with it at a young age, that the obsession would carry on. Wow. But yeah, Last of the Mohicans.
All right. I feel like, I don't know, with Graham continuing to comment this, maybe I should, like, watch it again.
Revisit it's Last of the Mohicans.
Bad movie.
I haven't seen it since high school.
I haven't seen it since before that. I haven't seen it since maybe middle school, and it was probably on TV. I don't even really have a great recollection of it, other than Daniel Day-Lewis saying Kentucky instead of Kentucky.
I had like a recent Michael Mann kind of resurgence, and that is a lesser one for sure.
Well, I would think so. I always consider like Michael Mann the whole like, you know, Heat and Collateral and all of his crime movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chantel says Beetlejuice. That was definitely very formative for me as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out Chantel.
My aunt, Graham's mother, says Wizard of Oz, which makes sense.
I mean, I kind of get that. I wouldn't say I was ever obsessed with that. I'm a bit younger than her, but I don't know. Like, we used to watch it every year at Thanksgiving when it would be on TV.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a yearly traditional movie kind of thing.
I don't know if obsessed is the right word, but that was probably the first movie to really scare me. Actual kind of horror movie vibes from. Like, obviously it's not that scary now, but as a younger kid, yeah, for sure.
That's Pee Wee's Big Adventure for me.
Well, I mean, I get that too. There's a couch that it feels like it could eat people.
Oh, it's all the truck, man. The truck driver. Her eyes pop out. Her face. It's that Burton-y face pop. Scared the fucking shit out of me.
I don't know if I've ever seen that.
Oh, God. Have children and make them watch it. It'll fuck them up.
Or just watch it yourself. Okay. Joe Cohn, who I don't know.
We have a listener?
Yeah, I think it's a real live listener. It isn't directly connected to one of our lives.
Fucking shout out to Joe Cohn. Let us know how to say your name.
Yeah. Was St. Elmo's Fire. It says, teeny bopper in love with Rob Lowe, particularly because of the Rob Lowe factor.
Hmm. All right. I mean,
never saw it. No comment.
Yeah, me either, actually. I've always meant to see that one and Some Kind of Wonderful. Those are like the 80s teen movies that are like a hole in my 80s teen movie knowledge. Robert Barnett says Alice in Wonderland. I'm assuming the Disney animated Alice in Wonderland because it's the best one.
Oh, yeah.
Also, I feel like, because we know Robert, I feel like it'd be really weird if he didn't get obsessed with a movie until the Tim Burton one just because of his age.
Right. Yeah, but also knowing him, maybe not that weird.
Yeah, that's true.
Alyssa, who's also been on the podcast before, says Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, I ever tell you I recently rewatched that?
Yeah, because we had this whole conversation about it being our least favorite Disney movie at a certain age.
Yeah, and so I felt like it needed to be, you know, sort of watched with fresh eyes. And I think I liked it less.
Wow.
I was not into it.
Do you have any firm memories of Hunchback of Notre Dame?
Hellfire, I remember being a fucking dope track. But beyond that, I don't think I felt strong. I was never a Disney animated kid, though, to be honest with you. I'm still not.
Oh, okay.
I was a huge Rugrats dude. I was really into cartoons. Scooby-Doo is just love fucking Scooby-Doo. But I never really got that hyped on the Disney train.
Interesting.
Okay.
Fair enough. I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Fair enough. Well, then you're not going to like this answer either. Ashley, who was on the podcast last week, says Little Mermaid from age 2 and up. And she says, when I was 15/16, I was absolutely obsessed with the Gerard Butler Phantom of the Opera movie. The one that I think Joel Schumacher directed.
Yeah, it's Joel Schumacher.
Yeah, which, if we're grading on a curve, is definitely not his worst movie.
We can have a whole Joel Schumacher podcast, man. I'll defend the fuck out of that dude.
You know what? I defend his 80s work. I think The Lost Boys is still like a pretty much flawless pop horror film. And
Tigerland.
Falling Down is a good movie.
Phone Booth.
Dates weird now because of reasons, but
yeah, Falling Down is kind of odd in today's climate, but Phone Booth is still awesome.
I didn't realize Falling Down was Joel Schumacher.
Yeah, and Flatliners, he was like a big deal.
Joel, and dude, Batman Forever, all right? Batman Forever is a dope movie. I'll go to bat for it. We'll do it. I'll come back. We'll do this out.
Jenaniah says it has to be Nightmare Before Christmas, which definitely, I think, people around our age who were growing up or coming up at a certain time, that movie was very big for them. I kind of saw it later in life. I didn't catch it in its initial wave, or else it might have been a big deal for me. But same. I think there was two reasons why it never became a film obsession for me. One is because I didn't see it till I was like 14. And two, I think it being a holiday film always kind of ghettoized it in my brain as being like not a movie for every purpose.
I don't like it. I like two scenes.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a pretty solid movie.
I think it's good. I don't have any problems with it. It's just like I think of it the same way as I think of, like, you know, any Home other Alone. Like, yeah, any other like Christmas time movie, so, with the exception of Gremlins.
What I will say against it being a holiday movie is because it takes place between Halloween and Christmas, it toes that line of, is it a Halloween movie or is it a Christmas movie? I say it's more of a Christmas movie because thematically it has more of a that kind
Christmas
of
Christmas message. Yeah. Yeah.
But I say the only real time to watch Nightmare Before Christmas is either the middle of summer or Thanksgiving. The only times you can't watch it are Halloween and Christmas. you left one out, which we don't have to talk about too long, but Chris Fowler says Star Wars. No surprise.
Oh, yes. No surprise there, yeah. Was the first person I showed when I got that box set. You had a hot take on Nightmare Before Christmas?
I personally am not a fan, but two great scenes. You know, this is Halloween's a great scene, and Oogie Boogie's whole shebang is fire. But
yeah,
I've just never thought that it really worked for me as like a comprehensive story. Just never really clicked. I think it trying to be a Halloween movie and a Christmas movie is just greedy. I think it's a greedy film.
That's what I mean. I don't think it's really a Halloween movie. I think it's really more of a Christmas movie because of, like, I don't know, the themes and stuff. But it does
have a song called "This Is Halloween" in it.
Yeah, I guess.
Which you can definitely play at a Halloween party.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And
but there's also, what's this, which is like a Christmas theme. Yeah, fuck it. It's a greedy fucking movie.
It's a fucking capitalist greedy film.
Fuck you, Jack Skellington.
Going into that, what Alec, I'll let you start. What was your earliest film obsessions?
I think
they don't have to be cool answers because
I'm gonna go with the cute one. I think if my mom listens to this, which she very plausibly will, I think she'll appreciate the shout out. When I was a little kid, I wanted nothing more than to watch Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. I wanted to watch it so fucking bad, and we had the VHS, I'm guessing, and we'd put it in, and then it'd get to one part, and I'd get too scared and start hysterically crying and turn it off. But then the next day, I would turn it on again, try it, get to the same fucking part, hysterically start crying, and turn it off. I must have tried to watch it for like 4 weeks straight before I finally got the courage to finish the movie. So I'm going to say shout out Jurassic Park is my first obsession.
Do you remember the part you couldn't get past?
I thought I did. I thought it was during the scene where they're like running in the fucking hills and all the dinosaurs are chasing. It's a big old kind of trampede sort of thing. My mother seems to think it was when the raptors start going into the kitchen and stuff, which would make more sense logically. I know, but I don't want to defend my young self as being afraid of like the actual scary part. Like, I could have been. What year did Jurassic Park come out?
93.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was one then. So let's say it came out on VHS. 2 years later, somewhere. I don't know. Let's say I was 4 when I tried watching this fucking movie.
Sure.
Okay.
I was not cool enough to make it to the scary scene, I think. I think I whipped out
prior. I think there's a really effective jump scares in that movie. It's a really thriller kind of ride. When Steven Spielberg wants to put on that hat, he puts that hat on. And I think there's really great scares all throughout that movie. I saw it when I was probably 7-ish in theater. Mm-hmm. And so I had nowhere to go because I was just there to watch it. But I was also so blown away by it and amazed by, you know, dinosaurs in the real world for the first time. It kind of overrid my absolute terror.
So that movie came out the same year as The Enchanted Forest came out. And I remember this because I was at that age, I think, yeah, I was like probably like 7, where my family would want to see a movie and then my mom might think it's too adult for me or whatever. So she would go see like whatever cartoon movie as me at the same time. Right. So that they could go enjoy the adult movie or whatever. And it came out when I was like obsessed with dinosaurs. It was during that, you know, that little boy phase where you're just like, I knew all their fucking names, frontwards and backwards. And my mom was like torn because she's like, he might be a little too young for it still, but he loves dinosaurs. And so she gave me the choice. She's like, do you think you could handle this? Or are we going to go see the Enchanted Forest? And I was just like, yeah, we're going to see Jurassic Park. Like, I don't give a fuck about that purple hedgehog. I didn't say it that way, obviously, because I was seven.
Right.
But yeah, so I remember choosing to see it. And I was like, I had to promise that I wouldn't be scared and I wouldn't get nightmares. And I saw it and I was just flabbergasted. I could not be less scared of that movie. Because I was just blown away by the dinosaurs. I was like, are you fucking kidding me with this shit? This is the coolest thing in the world. Like, there was no way I could be scared of the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. So would that be your answer as well, Keith?
No. I mean, there's a bunch of movies I could say. I think the first movie I was obsessed with was probably the Transformers cartoon.
Mm-hmm. Which was also your answer from last week as well.
Yeah.
For the last time we did a survey.
I know, so I wasn't going to use it. I just remember renting it a lot, like every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, the Disney's Aladdin. I remember we... Uh-huh. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before too, but I remember watching it at, I was visiting my grandma in Georgia, and we didn't get to visit Georgia very often because it was like completely on the other side of the country from us. Yeah. And I got very sick and I couldn't really do anything. Mm-hmm. And she had a copy of Aladdin on VHS. So I just remember laying on the couch and watching it and then stopping it and watching it again and stop. I watched it so many times that she just let me take it home.
Yeah, that's a good answer. That's probably pretty close to one of mine as well. I had whole swaths of that movie memorized. Yeah. And me and my friends would do entire scenes on the bus. Just,
oh, that's embarrassing.
A little bit, yeah. But I mean, we were like six or whatever. So, and I think... it was a pretty close to the same when Lion King came out too. I definitely had a lot of that memorized because I'd seen it so many times. And when you're that age, you just soak up information in a way more efficient way than you do now. So yeah, those are good answers. Probably the first few of mine would be Disney animated films. Also, on a less cool or less acceptable answer, I was pretty obsessed with both the Double Dragon movie from the 90s.
And yeah, you were. I fucking remember that.
Yeah,
loved that movie, man.
I did too, with Scott Wolf. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the Jean-Claude Van Damme Street Fighter movie.
That's awesome. Did you know who wrote Double Dragon while we're just amazed by this subject?
No, who?
Paul Dini? Paul Dini of Batman the Animated Series. Acclaim.
Interesting.
How wild is that?
That's
pretty
weird, actually.
I am in love with Double Dragon, and it is so hard to find on DVD.
It was on Netflix for a while. I remember because I made Brad and Amanda watch it when they were on this podcast.
Shout out Brad and Amanda.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's fun. That's our survey that we conducted. And be sure to check out our Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast to see when we post other questions like that. If you haven't already followed us there, you can do that and join in on the fun. Ooh. Let's go ahead and get into reviewing some movies now. And we're gonna start here with Spike Lee's Black Klansman. Yeah. And Alec, if you would be so kind, please summarize without spoiling, mm-hmm. Black Klansman.
Sure. So it's the true life story of Ron Stallworth. He joins the investigation department of the police and quickly decides, after seeing a advertisement for the Ku Klux Klan, that he would try to join them. The twist is, he's black. So he calls up the Ku Klux Klan, says,
in his very specific voice. Hello. I hate all the same people that you hate. How about I join your nifty organization? And then they pull him in. He brings in Adam Driver to play the actual physical representation of himself for the clan's meetings and whatnot. And hilarity ensues? Question mark? How's that?
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. The lead actor in the film, John David Washington?
Yes, sir.
Now, what is... He was in...
He's Ballers. In Ballers!
Yeah.
He's also Denzel Washington's son.
Yes. And Denzel Washington is a longtime collaborator of Spike Lee, so that makes sense.
True. Not for a while.
I also think, like, I don't think he looks that much like Denzel Washington, but I think his voice and just, like, his rhythm, the cadence of his voice sounds so much like Denzel.
We're going to have to block out, like, a couple minutes to talk just about his voice in this movie. But I'll save it.
I kind of know where you're going with that.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty big cast. It's kind of an ensemble. I mean, he's definitely the star of the movie, but there's a lot of people surrounding him, including... Yeah.
Adam Driver. Topher Grace as David Duke.
Mm-hmm.
We have a, I believe, the son of Steve Buscemi as one of the cops as well.
Brother? Yeah,
Is it brother? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which threw me off.
Me too. I kept thinking, that dude looks a lot like Steve Buscemi.
But then I was like, no, it's not. Oh, maybe it is. Like, different lighting, he would look more like him.
Yeah.
He actually, I think, looks... Ashley and I got a little obsessed with him after seeing it. But he actually looks less like Steve Buscemi in different lighting and makeup. The way they did him in this movie was like, oh...
So one of the reasons I had you on, Alec, is because I know that you've been a big fan and proponent of Spike Lee.
Sure.
I've seen a handful of his movies, and I've, you know, to varying degrees, he's kind of a hot and cold director with most people. Mm-hmm. And he's had a long enough career that he's been on all over the spectrum of quality. I've always said that, you know, whatever you want to say about his later work, whether you like it or don't like it or whatever, he may do the right thing, and the guy who may do the right thing is allowed to blunder every once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even more, like, I love Do the Right Thing, but even more, it's Malcolm X for me, and I feel like, you know what, man, he made Malcolm X, so let's just, I don't care what he does.
Well, I think that first push, that 86 through 96, was really, like, his hot streak when he was really carving out a name for himself and was a big mover and shaker in, like, the early independent scene and all that.
Sure.
And kind of, you know, the whole New York independent scene. And, you know, along the way, there's been other films of his that I've liked, too. I've really liked 24th Hour. And I haven't... I saw his Old Boy remake, which was not very good. But
No.
Yeah.
But to his credit, he does... kind of renounced that film. He did not get final cut on it, so he was not a fan either.
Fair enough.
Summer of Sam, though, I think great flick, probably one of John Leguizamo's best performances. And
I've always wanted to see that movie and never got to. That's on my list.
It's really long, super long. It's like 3 hours and change, but it's fantastic. It's great.
But something that's kind of interesting that's happened with this film is that it, not only is it done very well critically, but it's also doing really, really well among audiences. I think this is, I haven't checked box office, but I think this might be one of his most profitable.
Could be.
Or by the time it's all said and done, I think definitely will be in the running. At least
Inside Man before that, though, right?
Possibly, yeah, because that was also more of kind of a commercial film.
Yeah.
And I think this actually kind of rides the line. We'll get into Inside Man when we do our Netflix homework, but I think this film, stylistically, and sort of philosophically, is kind of riding the line between his obsessions as an auteur and sort of like his life's work and sort of the racial stuff that he's always brought into the themes of his work. And then also a little bit more of a populist, you know, private eye sort of movie genre thing. That also has its roots in blaxploitation. And I was a little uncomfortable about bringing that up until they have an entire conversation about blaxploitation. I'm like, okay, I feel justified in seeing those parallels now.
Well, there actually is an older film called Black Klansman that is a little bit more literal about it. It's just about a very light-skinned black dude who joins the Klan, and it gets quite violent. It's quite good, actually. So when this was first announced, I thought he was just remaking that. And I was kind of interested. I don't know if you want to get into actual reviewing of the movie yet.
Yeah, let's go ahead. What general impressions? What did everyone think?
I really enjoyed the movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought it was going to be a little more blaxploitation-y, but I'm actually glad that it wasn't. I think this movie does a pretty good job with setting a lot of tension. Like, there were multiple moments that I thought was going to sort of devolve into a Inglourious Bastard style bloodbath.
There's a lot of scenes that feel like it could go that way.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm not really familiar with the true story or anything like that. So I was just like, for a lot of it, kind of on the edge of my seat, just sort of enjoying the ride I was on. Uh-huh. And then without spoiling anything, the last like 10 minutes feels like a punch in the dick. And
in a good way?
In a way that I'm just like, the very end of it makes it, it sort of feels like a 70s adventure movie, right? And then the last little bit of it, the little bit of epilogue, is just like, oh, no, this is fucking real. And if you weren't, like, the movie sucks you in with this sort of pseudo-fantasy. It almost feels like a fun buddy cop fantasia. And then at the end, it's just like, oh, no, this is fucking real shit. Yeah, so that was my general takeaway.
So we're going to commit to not saying anything about those last, like, 2 minutes? Is that...
Well, I mean, I don't think that it's a spoiler to say that, because it's not even diegetic. But, they as a coda at the end of the movie, they tie in some footage of the Unite the Right rally that happened last year, in which white supremacists were marching the streets shouting, blood and soil, the Jews will not replace us, and ended in a white supremacist killing a protester. And the movie is dedicated to her, Heather Heyer, at the end before the credits. So, I think that was one of the, like, stylistic flourishes that was very Spike Lee in this movie. That was him, like, totally pulling the sword out of the sheath and saying, like, you know, I've entertained you, I've given you all the movie stuff. Now,
oh, for sure.
Now let's get to sort of the bigger picture stuff. And I think that along the way, they are making some suggestions towards the stuff we're dealing with now. There's a one point where they're having the conversation.
Oh, not so about, subtle suggestions.
Yeah, I mean, literal phrases.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, granted, some were rooted in. Like, the Klan did go with America First. That was an old-timey racist phrase.
Yes, absolutely. And they have this whole, like, dialogue set piece about how the Klan is trying to infiltrate mainstream politics with David Duke, and he's, like, trying to rebrand the Klan as sort of being, like, this more sort of upper class thing. There's swaths of his speeches that you hear throughout the movie, or sort of the conversations he's having over the phone with the lead character, where if you close your eyes, you think you would be listening to Richard Spencer talking right now.
Which, by the way, shout out to fucking Topher Grace.
He was good. I think he steals the show.
Before we move too far away from the end bit, I do kind of want to bring up one thing, because it's probably my biggest complaint about the movie. And I'm really sorry if this gets you, like, a bunch of hate mail. I'm kind of confused by this movie being dedicated to her. And that's not to besmirch her memory. What was her name again?
Heather Heyer.
Have this misconstrued as anything against her. She clearly died in a very unfair way, doing a good thing, being part of a protest that I think is really important. But it does seem odd that a movie about the Ku Klux Klan that has this pretty powerful monologue by Harry Belafonte, it feels odd that a movie that is mostly about the way black people in America were murdered ends with a dedication to this white lady.
And it put an odd taste in my mouth. And I'd obviously want her to be highlighted, and her, mm-hmm. she's important, she matters, but it, mm-hmm. it seemed fucking weird to me. And I
think that's fair. I kind of felt the same thing. I thought that in the overall grand scheme of the parallels they're trying to show is like, this led to this, like the dots that they're connecting on the timeline, and sort of like, you know, reaching through the screen into the real world. I thought that it made sense for that, but I do agree that it was a weird choice, especially from Spike Lee.
But yeah, I mean, there are plenty of black people and brown people who've been murdered recently that we could also pick from, though.
Here's the thing. I think that was my takeaway from that was that it was sort of intentional, because a lot of this movie is about you know, the differences between black America and specifically white fucking racist America, and mm-hmm. and I think in context of the movie, to me it felt like.
Like sort of like an olive branch?
It sort of felt like this is your fucking problem too.
Yeah, I think that's what he was trying to maybe do. And I think mm-hmm. people take issues more seriously if white ladies get hurt by them too.
I think she was a victim of the Klan. I agree with what you're saying, but while I was watching the movie, I didn't feel that way. It felt because there's that whole section where Adam Driver is talking about how he doesn't feel connected to this project. How you know, it's obvious the connection for Ron Stallworth, mm-hmm. but he's the one risking his physical life and physical body for this. And he doesn't know why. And so to me, it spoke to that because it was like, well, this hatred, this does affect white people too. So that's how I took it. But
yeah, but it seems unfortunate to me that to make this point, we had to be like, by the way, white people, this also affects you. And
I agree. I mean, I can see that perspective.
And I mean, this is also me being bias. I saw it with my girlfriend, who is black, and so when it ended, she turned to me and she was like, what the fuck is up with this white lady being the person that this is dedicated to? And so my reaction is partially based off of her reaction.
No, but
I
sense.
Mean, I think her reaction is pretty spot on, and I also will say that, like, I am a very similar to Adam Driver in this movie, actually, in that I am technically Jewish, but never really was a good one. But I get that same kind of paranoia when people are shouting, you know, Jews will not replace us and shit like that. But even still, I felt Selma did a similar thing. You know, they spotlighted two Jewish men who were killed during the civil rights movement, and I'm glad that they shouted them out, but they also shouted out that this was a mostly black issue. And it put a weird taste in my mouth. And I'm not trying to the conversation to just be about that, but it felt like a weird
I think that's fair. I definitely was kind of like, huh, that's a little curious. I didn't dwell on it too much, largely because I was trying to really kind of in my head I was really trying to see what the movie was trying to accomplish. Fun is, seems like a weird word to use, but this movie is intentionally populist in a lot of ways. It's entertaining on purpose. There's a lot of laugh lines. There's a lot of like silly characters, that kind of stuff. Even on the KKK side, or I should say, especially on the KKK side, there is very tense moments that goes into full thriller mode. There is some moments where it feels like a cop procedural, and mm-hmm. I think that it rides all of these different genre waves pretty seamlessly in a way that I don't even know if I've seen Spike Lee try to do as broadly as this. Like, if this were like a Tarantino thing, this is his game. Like, this mm-hmm. is what he does, is that kind of genre blending.
It actually reminded me a lot. Like, I think it feels a lot like a Tarantino movie.
Well, yeah. It feels post Tarantino for sure. I think the style is not necessarily his, but it feels like a type of movie that would be made because he made something like Jackie Brown, which is funny because Spike Lee and Tarantino don't necessarily get along IRL.
True. And I think some of the things that Django suffered from, or people thought it was just overly, every time a group of racist people got together, it was just nonstop and to such a degree. And I think this movie does it too. And it does it in a slightly better way, I will say, than Django. But like, still, it's like, yo, how many times are we going to, in this movie, get into a room of white dudes who is like, we got to kill all these people and fuck them and fuck them. And I was like, ah, yeah, I got it, man. I for sure got it. This movie's 2 hours and 15 minutes. You could have cut one of these.
I don't know. I feel like,
I think in the case of this movie, it was more necessary because I think a lot of people, especially people our age or even younger, and I think to some degree that is why we're seeing a rise in white nationalism again amongst young people, is because they never really experienced this stuff 1.0. They never experienced it the first time around. They never really got, and they're so far removed from it now that it's not really being taught in schools in the same way that it used to be. Like, the echoes of it aren't really in the air anymore. So now when they're approached with this white nationalist rhetoric, it seems new and fresh. It doesn't seem like, oh, this old fucking thing that's horrible and it's been around forever. And so I think it's good and interesting to see that, like, this stuff is not new. It's just being rebranded and repackaged for you. And it used to be like this not that long ago. And it used to be much worse not very long before that.
I also think there's something to say about the white characters, the Klan characters. They're somewhat likable. Like the fat guy, he has some like funny, endearing moments. And I think there's a intentional contrast with humanizing them and making them say the most horrid shit possible, because it's like that whole argument of, you know, you'll let your friends get away with things because they're your friends, and if they're acting friendly towards you, you're more accepting of it. Mm-hmm. And so just like, I think that in the case of this movie, where it is a little bit different than Django, it does feel a bit more purposeful, because it feels like it's helping to tell that, to propel that story. But I also, you know, I also get that hearing it a lot is uncomfortable, and you know, people who don't like that, that's fucking valid. So, you know, if it is something that bothers you to hear, you know, so I do get that, you know, it's hard to hear over and over and over again, and to see multiple scenes where it's just like uncomfortable and gross.
It's not, I mean, this could be a way longer talk, but I see what you're saying. I'm not sure it's exactly how I feel, but I see what you're saying.
Well, how did you feel about Alec, specifically? How did you feel about it overall, as far as like, you know, just a three act story? You know, did you think it paid off in the genre stuff?
I in general, I liked it. I know I'm like kind of really nitpicking and shitting on it, but I liked it. I thought it was fine.
Where would it rank for you in the pantheon of Spike Lee? Like, somewhere in the middle?
I mean, it's his best one in years, but that's me not liking anything he's done in years. I mean, it's below a lot. It's better than Chi-Raq, which it was another one that was like critically got a lot of love for some reason I don't really understand, because I thought it was really quite bad. But it was better than Chi-Raq. It was definitely worse than a lot of his movies, in my opinion. I mean, it was cleanly shot. It was very crisp. There was some cool directorial choices, I will give it. Mm-hmm. And some really good performances that I was, like, very into. I'm kind of back and forth with Washington in it, though.
As the protagonist?
Just as his performance. I if we can dig into the themes of the movie for a second.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think like dual identity is a big part of it.
Yeah.
So there's the dual identity, you know, they give you the line, because sometimes this movie just gives you a line to explain what it's talking about.
Yeah, and if I had any like serious complaints with the movie, is there's a lot of on the nose stuff. Kind of all over the place. Yeah. But I think for me, it makes up that deficit. But I know what you're saying.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, I enjoyed it, and all my shitting on it, I still mostly enjoyed it. But the line that Ron has, where he says that he can speak the King's English and jive. Mm-hmm. Right. I find that very fascinating. I'm personally very interested in code switching and this ideal of having dual identities. So I'm always very fascinated by that as a topic.
Mm-hmm.
And though it was brought up, we don't actually see it happen. We never really see Ron fitting in anywhere. Both environments that he's in, he's not one a part of. And you can, you know, argue maybe that's the point. But it seemed... It didn't feel effective to me in the way that, I don't know if either of you saw Blindspotting.
I did.
Okay, well, I feel like Blindspotting covered a very similar subject in a significantly better way.
I would say in a more audacious way, in a way that seemed a little bit more hungry to be there, for sure. I would say the same thing about Sorry to Bother You.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh, man, you really should. But
I keep getting mixed reviews, and I haven't run out to it yet.
Oh, well, whoever's saying the other thing, they're wrong. But so you should definitely go see it. But all three movies, I think, are really interesting in that the way they're playing off of each other,
mm-hmm.
and how they attack similar themes in a similar way. But anyway, yeah, no, I think that code switching and dual identities is a major theme. I think, yeah, I would say it's intentional that he never really feels committed to a side. I mean, because we see early on in the movie, his first undercover job is to infiltrate a Black Panther event where he's kind of flirting with radicalization, as he's also literally flirting with a girl and trying to get with her throughout the movie.
In a weirdly put together scene as well. That whole initial flirt feels real slapdash.
To me, that feels very 1970s blaxploitation. Like, to me, like, that their relationship in particular and the way that it plays out, not just because of the afros and the period costume, but the way that thread runs throughout the movie seems the most rooted in that tradition. So I think there's a little bit of a corny on purpose there, but maybe I'm giving it too much credit.
I mean, I can see it.
And then also, so he never really quite commits to being a part of that, even though he has a connection to her. And of course, obviously the racial connection. Feels very, very connected to this case that he's working on, with the Ku Klux Klan, because that's going to be his big ticket into being respected amongst the police officers that he also doesn't fully feel connected to. So I do think that he's kind of a person without a place, without an identity. And I think if you had a stronger kind of, you know, Jamie Foxx type in this role, who, I think it would be harder for somebody like that to be able to recede in the way that he needs to, and to be as chameleonic. Now, it's not a powerhouse performance, in the same way that we see a lot of the other side performances. It's not a showy, for sure.
Yeah.
But I think that it serves its purpose.
I watched an interview earlier with the actual Ron, and I will say that I can almost see Washington kind of going for the man's actual voice. But to me, what it played as was a man very clearly doing his best white guy impression. To the point where it actually almost sounded identical to me to Dave Chappelle's old white guy, which I thought was really funny at first, because I thought, oh, this is the voice he puts on at work. But as the movie went on and he just continued it, I started to feel like this is an actor putting on a voice, and I never really bought it as a genuine voice.
See, I kind of agree with that, but again, I think it was, I don't know. I sort of saw that as slightly intentional, because Adam Driver and John Washington's voices never really line up. And I think that, I don't know, maybe it was just kind of something that slipped through the cracks, but I kind of thought that that played to sort of the credibility of the Klan. Like, like to me, you know, all David Duke had to hear was, you know, I'm a white guy who hates all of, you know, all of these other categories of person, and he was willing to listen, you know, again, maybe I'm overly reading into it, but to me, I sort of read it as like, he didn't want to look past anything. Like, it was sort of obvious. I don't know.
No, sure. I think thematically, if we like talked about intention, which is something I'm mixed on in general with like film criticism, but
yeah,
we could definitely defend a lot of my complaints. But what it really boils down to is just a performance decision. I think it lacked viability for me. And it felt so much like him putting on a voice. You know, I feel it's a complaint people had about Ryan Gosling for a long time, was why is this dude from Canada clearly doing this like weird New York accent in Remember the Titans?
That's his fucking accent and everything.
Yeah, and he's talked about it and how he just thought that's how people talked because of whatever, but... for me, with Washington in this film, I felt it was a choice that never paid off. Personally,
all right. Yeah, and then maybe because of the movie makes such a point to point out voice, yeah, that kind of makes you think about it more than you would normally. Because you're listening for when it might change from scene to scene. I'll agree with you. He's not the most charismatic person on the screen at any given time. Like, given the fact that he's the main character, I'm usually looking at whoever else is on screen. Even the girl who plays opposite him, Adam Driver, you know, and Topher Grace.
I thought both Adam Driver and Topher Grace were really good in this. I am just a Adam Driver fan, though. I've pretty much liked everything I've seen him in. Yeah, so
same. Corey Hawkins too, for his little guest spot, I thought he was fantastic.
Oh, as Kwame?
Yeah, Kwame.
Yeah, he was really good. He had that big monologue in the movie. You know, the gentleman at the end of the movie, there's another kind of like almost like a bookend monologue there.
Harry Belafonte, right?
Yeah.
So I have there was only one part that stood out as really odd to me in this movie, and we've sort of talked about every other aspect of the movie that I figure we're doing a deep dive here.
Go for it.
The only part that sort of sat off with me was the prologue with Alec Baldwin. Did that feel weird to anybody else? I don't know. I thought it was a strange tone to set, and I guess it was just sort of setting up the world that John Washington was walking into, mm-hmm. but it felt very weird to me. Like, it felt very
style.
I don't know. Like, it felt a little too much because it's sort of mimicked by that scene with Corey Hawkins, right? That you're sort of getting these ideologies, and to me, it felt a little like. Like, is this presenting a... I don't know. It felt very strange to me.
Well, to me, that's one of the Spike Lee-isms, right? So a lot of his movies, he has these direct-to-camera confessionals.
Okay.
And in that, in the case of that one, he's obviously, like, reading a script, and they even kind of point that out where he's flubbing lines and going back and redoing it.
Yeah.
I think largely it's a tone setter. And I think it also plays into how little has changed really since this time, because there's a lot of that rhetoric that sounds very similar to things that are coming out of the White House today.
Sure, I mean, he sounds just like fucking Alex Jones.
Yeah, well, literally does. And all that stuff, again, is not new. It all comes from a place. It's all, you know, fascism 101, really.
It's just like, of all the scenes, that one in particular to me was like, felt just really long. And like, even Alec, you made the case with, you know, like, hearing the white supremacists and stuff. And I was just like, especially in this instance, I was like, I don't want to hear your point of view anymore. I don't know. It just felt very long and, like, strange to me.
I think the movie in general does a thing. The more I talk about it, the more I keep thinking about it, how it seems to just be doing occasionally less good versions of things I've seen in better films. Or even not necessarily better films, just things I've seen done better. Because it's not... The Alec Baldwin sequence isn't overly dissimilar from the DiCaprio sequence in Django, where he's going through the skull.
Uh-huh.
And that is a better scene. I think that the cutting at the end, to be like, look, a lot of the things that were said by the Klan and things are being said now are really similar. That was done way better in Ava DuVernay's 13th documentary, because that did a similar thing, but significantly better. A lot of this dual identity thing, I think, was done better at Blindspotting. And I don't know. The more I'm thinking about it, maybe I really just was super underwhelmed by this movie, but it just happened to hit a lot of things I find interesting, and so I'm looking for interest.
Hmm. All right. Yeah, I mean, I liked it enough. I mean, I will say that I think it's a little bit more pedestrian than people are giving it credit for right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's relevant, and the topics it brings up are good, and I think that it you know, brings up those topics in a way that's effective and entertaining at the same time. But I do think that, like, as a story, if we're just looking at, like, the nuts and bolts of it, of the, like, kind of detective story aspects of it, it's fine, you know. Yeah, there's not a lot of big revelations and stuff. And I know that they're kind of dealing with a story, a true story. And to be honest, there's this whole thing with Boots Riley where he's been the biggest critic against the movie. And it's really interesting to me. Yeah, he wrote like this 3-page essay about how they distorted the actual story to make this Ron Stallworth character seem like more like he was down with black liberation than he actually was, and how they kind of try and make the police look better than maybe they were.
Interesting.
Which is really interesting, because the movie is not very, like, does not hold back on its criticisms of the police either.
Yeah, but at the end they, like, arrest, or I don't want to fucking spoil shit.
Right,
but...
no, I know what you're getting. Yeah, and that scene, even without having seen the Boots Riley thing, definitely didn't ring true to me.
Yeah, that felt,
look, there's a bunch of good cops, and fuck you.
It seemed like just Schadenfreude. But I
actually didn't mind it, though. Like, I could tell that was, like, again, sort of this, like, Fantasia element. But mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, fuck that guy.
No, I mean, it's meant to manipulate the audience in that exact way, which is why I found it a little obnoxious. Yeah. But I like...
fuck you, Cassidy. Just because a movie wants you to feel something doesn't mean it's wrong to feel it.
No, it seemed a little pandering to me, that particular moment. Not everything in the movie.
If you're going to pander to me, really, like, commit to it, you know? Yeah. Punch him.
Don't invent a straw man to burn down by the end of the movie.
Exactly.
Generally speaking, I came away liking this movie much more than disliking it. I would recommend it. I think it's even if you're not, like, totally invested in quote unquote the politics of the film, which seems ridiculous to say.
I don't see how you could see this movie and separate yourself from
not have an opinion about it. But I do think that it is a good time at the theater, and I was sort of just invested in it as a story, and particularly for the performances as well. And I do kind of like the sort of grainy 70s look of the movie and stuff, what they're trying to go for there. So I give it, like, it's a B+ for me.
All right. I actually really enjoyed it. Like you said, I think I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, as fun as, you know, this kind of subject matter can be, to the point where...
But the movie's purposely playful.
Yeah. To the point where the ending, the prologue, feels like a punch in the gut. And I think that was intentional. And I appreciated that. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen some of these... I haven't seen specifically Sorry to Bother You or Blindspotting yet. So, you know, maybe it helps that I don't have those in my recent memory, or I don't have those as sort of contextual conversation pieces. But I liked it. I had a lot of fun. I think there's some really effective, tense moments in... And I feel like the more punch in the guts we can get, specifically against being racist, because apparently we still have to have conversations about Nazis, the more I'm like, yeah, let's have a fucking bunch of movies where we're saying fuck those guys. Yeah, great. I give it an A-. I really enjoyed it.
I've been kind of tinkering back and forth on my Letterboxd about it, kind of teetering between a 3 and a 3.5 out of 5, so I guess that would push me to what, like a C?
Yeah.
About a C. I wanted to like it, and I think I was just a little overwhelmed by it, maybe just a little underwhelmed. Some really great direction. It felt the most... smartly directed Spike Lee movie I've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Felt like he really did get his hands in it. I'm very interested in what the original script is like, because I saw that Spike and a writing partner rewrote two other people's script.
I think this had been in the works actually for a while, which might have to do with, and it's based on the novel by, or the book, biography or whatever, Black Klansman by Ron Solomon.
Yeah,
and that source was what Boots Riley had took umbrage with, and right. I think it's interesting that the biggest voice out there criticizing the movie is criticizing it from the left. All right, well, we're gonna keep on the Spike train, me and Alec, because we're going to talk quickly about Inside Man, which is on Netflix now, and I'd never seen it before, but I'd heard that Inside Man was kind of him trying to get his mojo back. Like, he had made a few stumbles at that time. He wasn't quite, the light wasn't burning as bright as it was in the early 90s for him. And so he kind of took a for hire gig. You know, this is, written by Russell Gerwitz. The same guy who ended up writing, that terrible movie, Righteous Kill.
Oof.
Yeah. And this movie isn't totally out of that wheelhouse. I would say it's directed quite a bit more competently. But yeah. This is also a kind of a cop procedural, but sort of a cops and robbers movie where Denzel Washington and Chiwetel Ejiofor get caught up in a bank heist that's being conducted by Clive Owen and his crew. They have this plan to end all plans. Their big way of getting out of what is surely going to be a huge clusterfuck of police surrounding the bank that they're in. This big New York Wall Street style bank is to dress all of their captives in the exact same attire so that when everyone leaves, the police can't tell any of them apart. Which is a weird hook because I was thinking along the way, like, oh, well, couldn't they just check like who's an employee of the bank and who has an account there like pretty quickly. it kind of follows along this, and there's a lot of other interested parties. We have Christopher Plummer who's the CEO of the bank, who has a shady history that he's trying to keep hidden, and he hires a sort of fixer played by Jodie Foster. And yeah, it's kind of like a Dog Day Afternoon kind of thing for the most part, until it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really great movie for, you know, what it is and for its genre. I think it's pretty much like a decent script. It's really, really lifted up by great direction from Spike.
Mm-hmm. How long has it been since you've seen this movie?
Probably about a year.
Okay, so not too long.
No, not too long at all. I think Clive Owen is fantastic in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Denzel's great in it as always because he's just tops. I mean, he's just like my guy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can see kind of what you're saying about the silliness, but I think just remembering the first time I saw it and then even rewatching it, I think that the finale is just very well put together, and it's got this very old school Hollywood kind of vibe to it.
For sure. Yeah.
It, almost Hitchcockian in elements. A little less.
I would say very directly. And there's many scenes that kind of feel like The Wrong Man or something like
yeah.
that. One of those kind of Hitchcock films.
One of his less
melodramatic pieces, but.
Yeah, or I don't know if you ever saw, I think it's called How to Steal a Million. Is that correct?
I never saw that one, no.
Old heist movie. But it had like...
Or even kind of like Kubrick's The Killing, like that kind of feel.
I've never seen that.
That's one of his first movies. It's a heist film. Like a pretty straightforward heist noir.
I mean, I love a good heist film. And I think what Spike does effectively is he puts a competent heist film together in a way that feels like it actually fits its time period, which is pretty hard to do. I think, like, when's the last time there was a really great, like, heist movie? Like, great.
Well, now you're putting me on the spot. I can't think of one. Yeah, you know, I didn't hate this movie by any means. I thought that it was perfectly fine, but I wasn't taken with it either. I get like his referencing of like he just wants to make like a competent, sleek, kind of modern noir heist film. Yeah. And I think that he pulls that off pretty well, and I like the dynamic between Denzel Washington and Clive Owen. I wasn't as into like some of the third and fourth party stuff, like the Christopher Plummer tract of the movie. And I get that kind of plays in pretty heavily towards the overall climax and stuff and sort of has to be there. But maybe it's just the way it's played out, the way they kind of tease it throughout. I wasn't into that. There's also this kind of narrative conceit where he's interviewing each hostage. And since I don't know who was a hostage and who was a perpetrator, they have to kind of play good cop, bad cop on everybody.
Yeah.
And they keep cutting back and forth from that. And sometimes I think that works, and sometimes I think it's kind of jarring and pulls me out of the narrative current. But, you know, I mean, as far as one of these kinds of good movies go, you could definitely do a lot worse. I enjoyed it enough, but I did think, like, I think there's a lot about it that doesn't age very well. It's very 2006, which is not something I thought I would ever think in my life.
See, that's interesting. It's kind of one of the things I think is charming about it, is that it feels in its period, but it didn't feel dated to me. It just feels, this is when this took place, and I feel it is saying that.
But there were certain kind of, like, production techniques that we kind of got over. Like, there's this oversaturation stuff that the movie does all the time, or, you know, using lots of, like, tinted greens and all of this stuff to sort of make everything sort of look more sleek and modern.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that I feel like Spike Lee has never done before or after that point, and that just really puts it in that year. Like you can see like how the way like advertising was done around the same time as well. I don't know, like there's
almost
a lot of like
Tony Scottish
feel. Yeah. I was just about to say that. Yeah, that kind of like hyper modern kinetic camera stuff that I'm not as into on a visual level.
Yeah.
But on a storytelling level, I think that he plays it out pretty well. I think that the third act, once, you know, Tarantino, to go back to him, when he was talking about Speed being one of his favorite movies, he said something to the effect, and I'm sure you've seen the interview too, that once they're off the bus, the movie's essentially over. And I kind of feel the same way about this movie. Once they're out of the bank, and there's still, like, for whatever reason, 25 minutes left of the movie, I'm just, like, totally kind of done. Like, I know there's stuff to wrap up, but I'm like, you've just deflated all the tension out of the movie now. So I don't super care about, like, this Christopher Plummer plot thing.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I alternatively, I'm a huge fan of that, like, Tony Scott real weird early 2000s kind of stuff that he was going for, with the exception of maybe Taking Pelham 1-2-3. I think it was trash. But I even like his, unfortunately, perhaps his last movie was Unstoppable, his last movie.
Yeah, that was fine. I actually don't have a problem with Tony Scott either. I just think that it's, I don't know, maybe I was expecting more out of this movie than I got, like, as far as the reputation it has. So when I saw it, I was like, it's fine as one of those kind of movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, look, it's Spike Lee being like, look, I gotta make a commercial hit, and I'm just showing you that I can. And I feel like he does it very effectively, and I like I said, I really like that Tony Scott thing. Actually, as a matter of fact, if Ridley Scott makes one more fucking horrible movie, Tony Scott's gonna be my favorite Scott brother.
You know what? That's actually completely valid.
I fucking love Man on Fire, man. I could watch that movie every week and be very happy. And so I like to watch Denzel do his thing. I like to watch him do it in a weird stylistic environment. I feel like that blends well with the way Denzel performs. Like, he is so strong and stable, and like, you could always be fixated on him. So if the camera's doing like kind of weird shit, or the colorist is doing weird shit in the case of this film, it's all kind of balanced by the presence of Denzel. And I feel like with Inside Man, it really works for me in the same way it also works for Man on Fire for me.
He kind of anchors it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I think actually it's kind of funny you have Denzel versus Clive Owen, and they both kind of function very similarly in sort of a, I guess, sort of modern Gary Cooper type, or even Humphrey Bogart-ish type of role.
Yeah.
I think that aspect of it, that sort of Michael Mann cop versus robber psychology stuff, is probably the most interesting aspect of it, although I don't think they commit to it enough to really have that highlight anything. And also, I think Jodie Foster, for some reason, is like degrading as an actress as she gets older. Like, I don't know why, but, like, you know, fucking Taxi Driver, amazing. Silence of the Lambs, incredible. Then, like, Maverick, I see what you're going for. And then this, you're like, why are you kind of bad? And then Elysium, you're like, Jesus Christ, what happened to Jodie Foster?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely am not out here to defend Jodie Foster's kind of fall from brilliance, but...
Yeah. It's to the point now where she's like a red flag if I see that she's involved in the movie, which is too bad because she was, you know, kind of a prodigy at one point. If I'm putting a grade on this, to me, this is a C. This is like a C+. It's definitely like fine if you catch it on USA and you're watching it with some pizza on a bagel or something like that. You know, in the grand scheme of things, as far as even Spike Lee films, like, I actually don't think it's that far removed from something like A Righteous Kill. It's just
interesting,
a little bit more stylish and better acted.
I was not into that movie at all.
No, Righteous Kill is really bad.
Well, that's really garbage. Yeah.
No, I mean, we are all in agreement about that one.
That is that was an Avi Lerner joint.
But if I had to give Inside Man a grade, it'd probably be a B. I will watch it. I'm not going to rush out. I'm not a big rewatcher in general. But if it were on and I walked into the house,
you wouldn't make them turn it off.
Yeah, I'd sit there.
Yeah, probably me too. I'd be like, oh yeah, there's some interesting stuff to look out of here.
And, you know, support Denzel and
sure
Spike, I guess.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for coming on to the podcast, Alec.
Of course, man. Anytime.
And I'm glad that we were all able to kind of get in here and weigh in on Black Klansman. Before I read off a bunch of stuff, do you have any social media or any kind of like blog or anything you want to direct people towards?
Not a big social media-er, but I do have a Letterboxd if anyone is interested in my opinions. It's just Alec_Scott, Alec_SCOTT. And that's me.
I'll put that in the show notes, too, so people can find
it. Oh, amazing. Yeah, I got 1,500 movies logged so far. For a while, I watched a movie every day.
Yeah, you did that. You did that 360 challenge.
Yeah. I was successful for 2 years, and then my third year I was short 4 movies, which kind of broke my heart.
That's still amazing.
Yeah, and this year I'm just it's a mess.
All right, cool. Well, yeah. Let's see. What do I want to say? I want to say that if anybody has anything they want to say about this episode or other episodes we've done of the podcast, you can reach us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. We'll read your responses on air. We'd also appreciate any kind of reviews that you might do on iTunes, a star review and a one sentence, kind of blurb. We appreciate that as well. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. And I'm going to try and get us on the, Spotify podcast app that they have now.
Oh, dope.
Section. So that'll look for that. Upcoming here soon. Let's see what else. You can find us on Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can find us on Instagram at Jabber Podcast. And I've already said, but you can find us on Facebook.com/Jabber Podcast. Keith, what is your stuff?
You can find me on Twitter at Keith Foster Kid, on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid, although, fuck Twitter forever, Twitter go fuck yourself, it is a garbage app. I'm just waiting till I lose enough followers to justify leaving it, but you can still follow me at Keith Foster Kid. Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com, tonight in San Diego, a week from when we're recording this, which is Monday night. So Monday, August 27th, we're doing a special one-off taping for the Kaboo Festival. So we'll feature all artists that are going to be at the Kaboo Festival. So that's going to be a pretty good show. I believe we're going to have some cool prizes. Like I think we're going to give away some tickets to Kaboo. So if you're interested in Kaboo at all, come see our show next Monday, at Loose Loft in San Diego. And then for the month of September, our improvised book club is doing something a little bit different. It's not really a book. We are doing improvised Shakespeare. So that's been a lot of fun. So if you're into the Bard, come check out book club. We're going to have shows, Saturday, September 1st, Saturday, September 15th, and Saturday, September 29th, at Old Town Improv Company.
Wow.
Wow, look at you with your busy schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I had to push some things around, so I'm trying to get back into it.
Yeah, I guess you can follow me individually at BC Cassidy on Twitter. If I don't annoy you within a 3-day period with my political reposting, then, you know, I'm sorry. If you want to lose followers, Keith, just do what I do.
Twitter's ruined comedy.
Keith's going to go on another Twitter rant. Be sure to listen to our friends who also do podcasts. They haven't done them in a while, but I told Patrick that he and Dennis should do another episode or a few or hopefully more episodes of Almost Educational. It's been a little while, but I hope that Rod and Moksha get caught up on the listening party, because the last episode they did introduced me to a new band that I am currently obsessed with. Who else? Bill and Brian at the Great Albums podcast. Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought. And what else is there, Keith?
Also check out Adam Connie at the Adamant Podcast and Campfire Shit Show. That's Campfire SHT Show.
Yes. And Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places, which I told them, since I know them IRL, we're going to have to do a collab if there's ever any movies that come out that have something to do with theme parks. All right. Well, that's the episode.
We'll have to wait till the Jungle Cruise movie with Dwayne The Rock Johnson comes out.
I forgot that was happening. Yeah.
Do a Halloween Horror Nights special.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I have some plans cooked up for the month of October, so. But,
oh, God damn it.
Alec, I appreciate you coming on and doing this with us, and I'm sorry that I've kept you up too late.
Oh, no, man. No worries at all. This has been great. Anytime. Thanks for having me, man.
He fucking never apologizes to me, and he keeps me up late all the time.
Oh, I bet he does. Wink.